Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar, our very special guest today, Mr. Daniel Hannan. Many of you will remember him from this YouTube video.
Prime Minister, I see you've already mastered the essential craft of the European politician, namely the ability to say one thing in this chamber and a very different thing to your home electorate. The truth, Prime Minister, is that you have run out of our money. Now, it's not that you're not apologising. Like everyone else, I've long accepted that you're pathologically incapable of accepting responsibility for these things. It's that you're carrying on willfully, worsening our situation, wantonly spending what little we have left. You cannot spend your way out of recession or borrow your way out of debt. And when you repeat in that wooden and perfunctory way that our situation is better than others, that we're well placed to weather the storm, I have to tell you, you sound like a Brezhnev-era apparatchik giving the party line. You know, and we know, and you know that we know that it's nonsense. And soon the voters, too, will get their chance to say so. They can see what the markets have already seen, that you are the devalued Prime Minister of a devalued government.
Yeah.
Bravo, Mr. Hannan. Bravo.
Well, thank you, Mark.
We are very pleased to have you here today. Let me, before we get any further into it, let me tell the listeners just a little bit about you. You are a conservative member of the European Parliament for the Southeast England since 1999. Your YouTube clip roasting Gordon Brown originally gathered 1.4 million hits. I think it's approaching 3 million hits now, which normally doesn't happen on YouTube unless a college girl exposes herself. We understand that you speak French, Spanish, and as Barack Obama would say, American, and you contribute frequently to the Wall Street Journal, the Times, the Washington Examiner, the Spectator, the Catholic Herald, and many others. Quite an impressive resume.
There you go. I think you pretty much said everything that needs saying. So
okay, well, we're done.
We can wrap it up there. Right?
I was going to say, quite a resume for a young man. Were you not first elected to office at age 27?
Yeah, do you know what? I think that was a mistake. If I had my life over again, I would try and do something else for a bit longer first. But it seemed in those days that we were about to reach the point of decision on Europe. That, you know, Blair had just got in and he was talking about abolishing the pound, taking us into the euro. And I thought, well, you know, you can't sit around and let this happen. Of course, 11 years have passed and nothing has really changed. If I'd known then what I know now, I suspect I would have spent the intervening 11 years more productively.
Ah, more productively. Well, I wouldn't feel too badly about it because, frankly, most of my relatives were still living at home with their parents at age 27. So at least you got off to a fast start.
Yeah, but I'm strongly in favor of citizen legislators. I mean, there's nothing worse than being a professional politician, and it's not something you want to carry on doing forever.
So you have other plans in the future besides being a politician?
Well, I'm hanging around because I still think that we're getting close to this moment of decision of whether my country is going to be an independent state or whether it's going to be part of a bigger country called Europe. And, you know, that is such a huge ethical decision for us. And feeling strongly about it as I do, it seems silly not to be here. But once that, you know, I'll tell you what, nothing would make me happier, Mark, than to have a situation where there are no British members of the European Parliament. I promise, as soon as the opportunity arises, to vote for the abolition of my own job, and then I will retire with a great sigh of relief as Cincinnati to his plow and go and do something more exciting instead.
We, of course, want to talk today about your book, The New Road to Serfdom, A Letter of Warning to America. And I would like to thank you for, at the beginning of the book, defending some of the common criticisms of America. And I'd like to take just a few of these and have you dive into them. The first one is, Americans know nothing of the world. Most of them don't even have a passport. Your thoughts?
Well, with that one, as with all the others, the interesting thing is how often you hear it from Americans, from American liberals, the way in which a certain kind of American lefty has started to see his country through sophist European eyes. And he does this even in defiance of all the evidence. I mean, you know, in every country in the world, most people are not, you know, most people are content to stay where they are. Right? That's true in Spain or in Italy or in France. But in Spain and Italy and France, it's considered a great kind of tradition, a wonderful thing that you have the, you know, Cantabrian peasant or the Aragonese farmer staying where he is. Whereas, of course, in the US, which is relatively a much more mobile country, and to which everybody had to move a fair distance in the first place to get there, this is regarded as a kind of, you know, symptom of small-mindedness and xenophobia and so on. So in this, as in so many other things, we see Europeans projecting on to the Americans things which they might more aptly make as criticisms of their own society, and a certain kind of American lefty falling for it.
Well, you know, we heard that during the 2008 election. There was much criticism of Sarah Palin for the age at which she obtained her passport, as if somehow Barack Obama living in Jakarta when he was 12 made him more suitable to the presidency.
I mean, it doesn't make you more or less suitable. I personally have had an almost Obama-like life of being moved around. I was brought up in Peru in South America. I've lived and worked all over the continent. I'm working in Brussels now. The problem is not whether or not you've traveled and worked in other places. It's whether you feel cut off from the people who haven't. And there are some American liberals who genuinely admire Europe because they think that it's, you know, more peaceable and more comfortable and so on. There are others who wear their Europeanism as a badge of snobbery. And that, I think, is a really un-American way of behaving.
Now, Americans are often criticized for being great polluters, polluters who are addicted to their cars. Your take?
Partly this, of course, there are more cars in the U.S. than in other places, which is, in large measure, a measure of geography and of history. There are large distances in the U.S., and as importantly, a lot of the towns in the U.S. were developed after the invention of the automobile, so they are very car-friendly. Now, that isn't the case in my own country. It isn't the case in most of the old world, where the villages are not well-suited to cars and where actually, in many cases, having a car can be quite awkward. But America is very much in line with almost any other New World society where the same conditions prevail. I mean, you might as well say the Australians or Argentines are addicted to their cars. And indeed, Europeans would be much more prone to use their cars if they weren't subject to a great number of coercive policies and taxes designed to stop them driving.
Of course, no criticism of America would be complete without criticizing Americans' love affair with firearms.
Well, and there's, you know, Europe has just been having an orgy of that, as you'll imagine, in the last couple of weeks. In every society, there are acts of random violence when disturbed young men lose their bearings. When a boy in Finland goes and shoots up his school, everyone sees it for what it is, which is just a tragedy from which it would be insensitive to infer political lessons. But of course, if the same thing happens in the US, well, it's another example of America's love affair with the gun. A really interesting thing that struck me in the aftermath of the horrible atrocity in Arizona. A number of British commentators were saying, you know, they jumped immediately on the political killing, you know, Sarah Palin to blame, da-da-da. And they said, of course, how peculiarly American that this tragedy should have taken place, the guns and so on. Of course, there's really no evidence that there was anything political about it. We're talking about a plainly mentally unbalanced man, tragically. If I do think of an obviously political assassination, or at least assassination attempt, the one that I think of most recently in our societies was the woman who tried to murder a Labour MP because he had voted in favour of the war in Iraq. And there was no question there that that was politically motivated. She admitted it in court, she boasted about it in court, and she had a number of supporters who were cheering her on. It's a strange thing that should have prompted less soul-searching in the United Kingdom than the Arizona case. And I suspect that tells you something about the way in which the media discourse on both sides of the Atlantic tends to be framed in leftist terms.
Indeed it does, and I want to get back to the book soon, but since we've jumped off onto the Tucson tragedy, we received an email question from Russell in Phoenix, and he would like your thoughts on the call for more civil discourse in the United States, you know, in the wake of the Tucson shooting.
Yeah, I mean, there is something bizarre to me about saying in one breath we need more civil discourse, we need less hate speech, and then in the next breath attacking the Tea Party generally and Sarah Palin specifically in terms that come close to incitement. I mean, it's got to be one or the other. My favorite, you guys have probably heard this before, but my favorite is a letter in the New York Times, sorry, an article in the New York Times by a Democratic former congressman called Paul Kanjorski, where he says, it's incumbent on all Americans to create an atmosphere of civility and respect in which political discourse can flow freely and without fear of violent confrontation. Now, here is the same guy talking a few months earlier about Rick Scott winning the gubernatorial race in Florida. He says, this is a direct quote, "That Scott down there that's running for governor of Florida, instead of running for governor of Florida, they ought to have him and shoot him. Put him against the wall and shoot him. He stole billions of dollars from the United States government. He's running for governor of Florida. He's a millionaire and a billionaire. He's no hero. He's a damn crook. It's just we don't prosecute big crooks." I'll tell you what I find really interesting about this. In his own mind, I don't think that it would have ever occurred to the former congressman that he's engaging in double standards. I've noticed this over and over again with people on the left, not with everybody on the left. I mean, obviously, there are some fair-minded liberals. But they simply can't see that the way they talk about conservatives constitutes the very phenomenon that they think they're complaining about. And you take some of the things they say about us and you try taking out the word conservative and substituting the word Jewish or immigrant or something, and you see how it sounds.
Well, the double standard is there, and in fact, Fox News is having a heyday with this. I mean, we have people like Ed Schultz at MSNBC calling for civil discourse, blaming conservative talk radio, and yet you don't have to go that far back in time to view a video of Ed Schultz saying he'd like to reach into Dick Cheney's heart, pull it out, throw it on the ground, I'm paraphrasing, stomp on it a few times, and then shove it back in his chest. And apparently it was okay when he said that, but now he believes that Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and the Tea Party are somehow responsible for the shooting in Tucson. So you're right, they do seem to be oblivious to their own past behavior, or for that matter, some of their own current behavior.
And future behavior. I mean, but maybe I'm going to be a bit kind of wet about this. To be honest, I do find some of the terms in which the debate is expressed on both sides to be shedding heat rather than light. And I think conservatives would do well to try and hold themselves to a higher standard and to say, look, you know, don't attack the person, attack the ideas. You're much more effective if you break down where your opponent is wrong rather than if you just call them names. But I mean, that's, you know, to move from that observation to saying, you know, this has actually caused violence when there is no evidence linking the two events at all. The whole thing has been invented, I think is a really spooky way of talking.
Well, having said that, if you had to do it over again, would you soften your attack on Gordon Brown?
I think I only the only personal attack which I made was when I said that he was incapable of taking responsibility for things, and maybe that was a bit over the top. But you can at least argue that that was a political thing. I mean, I didn't attack him in personal terms. I didn't say, you know, you unpatriotic, terrible man. I accept that he was, after his own lights, trying to do his best. It's just that he was wrong. It's something, you know, you spend 10 minutes online and you realize this, something that comes up again and again. When a conservative attacks a lefty, usually he will call him naive and he will attack him for being well-intentioned but having made a mistake. Whereas the reverse is not true. If you look at how left-wing comment threads go, it's always, you guys are loathsome, you're hateful, you're evil. It's amazing how quickly they use the word evil. You know, having dispensed with the word in the way that it's traditionally understood by the monotheistic religion, they now use it to mean someone who disagrees with me. So, for example, Michael Moore says, capitalism is evil, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what he's really saying by that is, I'm a nice guy. I care about the poor. And therefore, anyone who disagrees with me must be wicked, must be, you know, morally at fault. Just think for a moment about how incredibly narcissistic it is to argue that way. Because what you're really saying, what Michael Moore is saying, is the worst thing a man can do is not to betray his wife or fiddle his taxes or lie to his friends. The worst thing he can do is to disagree with me. It is a quite amazingly solipsistic way of thinking.
Michael Moore, of course, being an interesting individual, if you read Do As I Say, Not As I Do by Peter Schweitzer, I mean, this is a guy who's frequently championing the cause of minorities in America, which is a good thing. But then when you examine his own record on hiring minorities for work in his films, he doesn't hire them. The same guy.
Well, I tell you the very best thing. I mean, I think this may be the single most delicious fact I have ever heard. Michael Moore owns shares in Halliburton.
Yes.
I mean, can you beat that?
Michael Moore's an interesting guy. I think he found the one really fine medical clinic in Cuba and has tried to convince Americans ever since that Cuba has a much better medical system than the United States. But you have to give him a few points for fashion, if nothing else. you're correct. We see this all the time. I mean, it's not something specific to the United States, but the double standard is clearly there. I mean, the same book by Schweitzer points out that Nancy Pelosi, for all her talk about environmentalism, was one of the investors in a country club, but building the club where they wanted to build it was going to threaten an endangered species of turtle. And, of course, the investors promised that they would relocate the turtles and make sure the turtles would survive. And then once they got what they wanted, the clearance to build the country club, they built it and said to hell with the turtles. They never bothered moving them.
No, sure. This is a really interesting, I mean, we have the same phenomenon here, you know, people who, I mean, a real shibboleth for the Labour Party in Britain is hostility to private education. It's up in their top three obsessions, except when it's their kids. And that's a whole different thing. And what I think is going on is it's the elevation of motive over outcome, which I'm not saying it's the exclusive property of the left, but I think I would argue in front of any court in the land that it is a more prevalent tendency on the left. This, you know, I don't need to give to charity because, look, I'm wearing the awareness ribbon. Yeah, I've already shown everyone what a nice guy I am. You know, why should I have to? Why should I have to help the poor? I've just called for higher taxes. Didn't you hear what I was saying? In other words, because I have signed up to a set of beliefs that establish what a caring, decent human being I am, that gets me out of having actually to do any of it. And you know, the scary thing is the extent to which the world goes along with this. The way in which our society does this, it's moralistic rather than moral. It puts more of an emphasis on holding the right opinions than on doing the right thing. My favorite example of this was an amazing story of there was a woman in Poland, a Catholic nun called Irena Sendler, who had the most amazing life. She was she smuggled Jewish babies out of the ghetto in Warsaw during the Second World War. And she kept lists of who their parents were, hoping to reunite them afterwards. I mean, of course, it didn't happen. Almost all the parents died in Treblinka.
In a laundry truck, if I recall.
That's right. That's right. And the incredible thing was she was captured and tortured. She wouldn't give up her list. And then she changed her name and went back to work. Now, you know, however you look at it, that is an amazing story. But here's the kicker. She was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And the Peace Prize instead went to Al Gore. But now think of the values that you're signaling when you make a decision like that. What you're saying is repeatedly risking your life to save children is worth less than making a politically correct film. Because kind of we can all buy into feeling good about ourselves simply by watching the film and saying, yeah, well, But, you know, I would, you know, I'm against global warming, so that's almost as good as saving the babies, isn't it? I mean, in a way, I am saving the babies just by being in favor of what Al Gore is saying. It's a very pernicious and invidious way of thinking, because it takes out the need for personal responsibility.
Well, you know, mentioning Irina Sendler, I'll let you know a little secret. I started a petition some months ago to strip Al Gore and the UN IPCC of their Nobel Peace Prize and to return it to the person or give it to the person who more deserves it, and that is Irina Sendler. And I think at this point we've had people from over 42 countries, several thousand people from over 42 countries signed the petition. And when you consider that the UK courts found numerous errors, I believe 9 in total, in Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth, and that we have seen error after error in that 2007 UN IPCC report that shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore, I don't think it's at all questionable that Irina Sendler.
But you know what? Even if it had been totally true, even if there were no errors in it, even if the whole phenomenon he's discussing were indisputable, you know, making a film is not the same thing as risking your life day after day and then retiring humbly and never boasting about it, right? And I think something has gone bad collectively with the mores of the world when we get so obsessed with expressing the right opinions rather than doing the right. Again, you see this very often in political discourse. You can be doing all the right things. You know, you can be trying to live your life properly, respecting other people, you can give to charity, you can work tirelessly for the poor, but it's all worth nothing in the eyes of a certain kind of commentator if, for example, you hold the wrong views about immigration or multinational corporations or whatever it is. And there is a really peculiar arrogance in that, you know, agreeing with the line matters more than almost anything else.
Yes, it would seem that attitude is more important than efficacy in terms of policy. And you were saying in your book, if I'm not mistaken, to the same point, that the cap and trade legislation that was being considered in America is a perfect example of this. Even those who favor it, you point out, acknowledge that it's likely to do anything to prevent the warming of the planet, but at least they can feel good about themselves for being on board with the right type of legislation.
Absolutely right. And in fact, the ones who are the most alarmist in their predictions about what's going to happen are the ones on whose own logic believe that the cap and trade legislation will be pointless. Because, you know, if the world really is going to warm by 6 degrees or whatever, then, you know, no one is pretending that this would have had the slightest impact, except, as I say, showing that you're on the right side. It's a kind of declamatory legislation. It's legislation that says, look what a nice guy I am, rather than legislation that aims for a particular outcome. Now, I'm very used to that in the European Parliament. I mean, that's 90% of what my colleagues do in the European Parliament. I'm alarmed to see the phenomenon crossing the Atlantic.
I love the example in the book of your fellow member of parliament who said, "Were you not listening? It's one of our top three priorities."
Yeah. I mean, my really favorite example was just after the tsunami, you remember 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
The European Parliament had a debate to say, well, look, you know, we need to give lots of money. Of course, it didn't mean their money. It meant public money. And one after another, people got into this auction. Let's give 5 million euros, let's give 10 million euros, hurrah, let's give, no, you know, 10 million is quite inadequate, I say we need 50 million, and everyone applauding more and more loudly, all feeling very good about themselves. And then this one elderly Italian guy, a very nice man, a Catholic Italian from the Christian Democrat Party, stood up and he said, well, as well as all this, colleagues, why don't we make a personal gesture? You know, we all get a daily rate for signing the attendance register, for being here. Why don't we give 1 day's attendance allowance to the Tsunami Appeal Fund? Now, this would have been about $300, okay? And immediately the warmth drained from the room. And the people who had been loudly cheering and whooping and ululating about giving 50 million of their constituents' money suddenly went completely cold at the idea of chipping in $300 of their own. And there you see that elemental truth that Milton Friedman pointed out, which is that there's two kinds of money in the world. There's your money and there's my money. And we are all a lot more careful about the second of those than about the first. The trouble with the European Union, the trouble with government in general, is that it's always somebody else's money.
Well, I had already referenced Peter Schweizer once, and in yet another book of his, The Makers and the Takers, he points out that conservatives are more generous than liberals across all income levels. So as we like to say in the United States, liberals are very generous with other people's money. So,
well, for that reason, because that then gets you out of it. I mean, that is, you know, that's the equivalent of saying, I don't need to give to the charity, because I have just expressed the view that taxes should go up. So that gets me out of having to do anything.
I'll have to try that myself. It seems rather convenient.
Now, yeah, it's a lot easier to be a liberal. Do you know what? It conveys all these miraculous advantages on you. You know, that the media are nice to you. You're regarded as kind and caring. You know, you want to help the poor. You love furry animals. It's a tough thing to be a conservative and be the opposite of all of those things, simply because you're sticking to what you know to be right.
You mentioned in your list of criticisms of the United States that Europeans even like to attack our television as being pure trash.
Yeah, I mean, this is just repeated over and over again in a sneering way. Oh, well, you know, American TV is trash. You know, they need a state broadcaster like the BBC. I mean, where do you even begin to unpick that one? You know, I mean, the whole world watches U.S. television program, not exclusively, but everyone watches, you know, The Sopranos, The Simpsons, Mad Men, you know, The Wire. These things are a universal export. I defy anyone to spend a week watching the TV in Spain, say, or in Italy, where it is a diet of kind of game shows and the trashiest kind of soap operas, and then seriously maintain with a straight face that American TV is trash.
Well, I was shocked to read that in your book, and my first thought was, have they not seen Dancing with the Stars?
Well, I mean, you know, the great thing is there is some trash on all TV, including in the US. Of course there is, and there is some very high-quality programming in Europe. But, you know, the reason I point that out, again, is a surprising number of Americans also believe this. They've kind of fallen for it, despite the evidence of their own eyes. I mean, people who have gone to Europe and traveled in Europe and must occasionally have turned on the TV in their hotel rooms will still come back and say, well, the Europeans are so sophisticated. They have all these wonderful nature programs and documentaries and so on. I mean, right, and that doesn't make them unique. But if you look at the balance of the thing, the sheer diversity of programming in the US produces more programs that other countries want to buy than the other way around, and you know that which pretty much settles the issue.
I was told that there was once a television program in Italy where housewives stripped for money.
Yeah, okay. I didn't say that there was no quality programming in Italy. I just didn't.
Well, and don't underestimate the UK. I mean, I was a Benny Hill fan at a very young age. In fact, I would sneak out of bed and go back to the television once my parents were asleep to watch it, because occasionally there was a bit of nudity. This was prior to HBO in America, so we didn't have that. So I was a big fan of Benny Hill, so I agree that British television is superior.
Actually, I think British television is not bad. I mean, the and it certainly compares very favorably with European TV. But the perverse thing about this is people then immediately turn it around and say, oh, well, you know, that shows that we need to have a state-funded broadcaster in terms of the BBC, which, of course, is the opposite of the truth. I mean, the bits of the BBC that they're talking about are the bits that are commercially successful and that are viable without government support. I mean, those are the one bit that you'd be certain to have anyway.
Has the story of the MTV programming with the nude underage children made it to Europe yet?
I can't say I've heard that one, no.
That's the latest thing. MTV has a series, and they have children under the age of 18, and they're all in one big massive pile, nude in one of the promo shots for the programming, and now it's being looked into as to whether or not MTV has violated federal pornography laws. So we'll follow that one. Now, wrapping up our
wrapping up our criticisms of the United States, no criticism of the United States would be complete without making a reference to America's history with slavery. You did touch on that in the book. Please share a little with our listeners.
I mean, this is the biggie. This is what it always comes down to, because if you are pro-American, if you think that the Republic stands for something, that the ideals that were encoded in the old courthouse at Philadelphia are uniquely benign and have done what they were meant to do, have served to keep the country prosperous and free, you'll almost always be told within minutes that it was all worthless because the Constitution only valued human beings at three-fifths of the worth of other human beings and so on. Now, I mean, there's a couple of things to say at the outset. First of all, of course, there is an element of truth in that criticism. It was a criticism that was widely made at the time, both by Tories in the US and in Britain, who were hostile to the project of independence, and by American abolitionists. But, you know, no country is perfect. Man is fallen, and all our institutions are flawed. And there isn't a nation on earth which, looking back on its past, hasn't done some things which are shameful from the perspective of the present. In a way, it's a good thing that there should be an element of falling short, because what that means is that you're trying to do better, that you see where there is an imperfection and you see your duty as being to try to rectify it. And in the case of slavery, that is more or less exactly what happened. So by all means, if we're talking about the history of the U.S., by all means bring up slavery, by all means bring up segregation, by all means bring up racial discrimination, but only if you're also giving the other side of the story. Only if you're also going to talk about the people who felt so strongly that the institution was wicked that they were prepared to risk death on the battlefield in order to bring it about. Only talk about segregation if you're also prepared to talk about the civil rights movement and about the reaction against it. And, you know, you can't disregard the fact that the U.S. has moved in the space of 40 years from the institutionalized exclusion of some voters on the basis of their color to the election of a mixed-race head of state. And what I would say to conservative listeners is that is everybody's victory. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you voted for Obama or not, right? If you're using the logic of collective sin, you have to use the logic of collective redemption. In other words, if all Americans, including those whose ancestors never owned slaves, are diminished by the fact that the institution lasted for as long as it did, then by the same logic, all Americans, including those who voted Republican, are in some measure part of the expiation that race has now ceased to be a bar to high office. And you know, the people who I think lost out most from Barack Obama's election, the people who most obviously stood to lose something were the old dinosaurs of the Black Power movement, you know, the Jesse Jacksons, the Jeremiah Browns. It's no wonder they tried to sabotage his campaign so much. It's no wonder that Jesse Jackson made that crack about wanting to cut his nuts off, because they could see that if he won, they were out of business. That the whole narrative that they put forward, which is that there is a limit as to how far you can rise if you're not white in the United States, and that the system is institutionally biased, that was going to be blown apart. And I think it's a very good thing that it's been blown apart, visibly blown apart, and all Americans, left or right, pro or anti-Obama, I think can take a measure of satisfaction in that.
One of the things that's being argued right now by people like Eric Rush, the author of Negrophilia, by C.L. Bryant, the producer of an upcoming movie, Runaway Slave, and by Star Parker, who will be on the show next week, who's written a book now in paperback, Uncle Sam's Plantation, is that as much as the right is criticized for being racist, it is the policies of the left, the entitlement programs, our welfare program, you know, our war on poverty, that have actually kept many minorities in America enslaved, not by the bondage of actual chains, but by their dependency on welfare. What are your thoughts?
Well, I put at the top of that list opposition to free schools and parental choice. I mean, if you damage the life chances of children by not allowing them to escape from sink inner city schools, that is a kind of invisible bondage that is almost as pernicious as the actual loss of liberty. I mean, you know, the thing is more ambiguous and more nuanced than saints and angels. Of course it is true that conservatives must take historically a measure of responsibility for behaving in a way that we would now find bewildering and unacceptable. On the other hand, let's not forget which party Abraham Lincoln was in. And let's not forget which party it was in the 50s and 60s that held up the civil rights legislation at a time when Republican congressmen, by and large, were very supportive of it. So, you know, I'm not turning it around and saying the left was wrong and the right was right about this. All I'm saying is it's a little bit more ambiguous than the way in which liberal commentators sometimes remember it.
That debate is heating up as more and more African Americans are stepping forward to discuss it. And you may have heard this, but we now have the formation of the first Black Tea Party, which will be based in Houston. I believe Anita Moncrief, who was an Acorn whistleblower a couple of years ago, and one of the goals of the Tea Party movement, Dan, is to bring more and more minorities into the movement, because we believe that the advantages of capitalism are there for everyone to take advantage of.
Of course. And the advantages of American freedom and the inheritance of the Constitution are for everybody. Now, I mean, belatedly in some cases and with dishonor and how long it took, but it's for everybody now. I mean, I think for any group, not necessarily a racial minority, but any group of people, whether they're defined by a religion or by a profession or by an income bracket, if they vote overwhelmingly always for the same party, then it is easier for them to be taken for granted, both by the party that they don't vote for and by the party that they do. And so it's got to be a desirable thing in a successful and pluralist democracy that we all make up our minds as individuals. We all look at the issues, we read the programs, we decide who is closer to what we believe in, rather than thinking, you know, I have to vote Democrat because I'm Catholic, or I have to vote Tory in England because I pay tax of a certain level or whatever. If I look at those countries in Europe where there is a national minority or a linguistic minority, where there's maybe a group of people who have been trapped outside their country and are a linguistic minority in another country, overwhelmingly in those places you have just one party speaking for the minority community. And those, in my experience, are the most corrupt, most complacent, and most useless parties anywhere in Europe, because they don't have to bother chasing votes. They can take their electorate for granted.
One of the great things about getting an occasional view from the outside is you have things pointed out to you that you might be taking for granted. Now, one of the things you point out in your book is the notion of open primaries and elected sheriffs and district attorneys and elected school board members. Talk to us about just how important that is to making America what it is.
It is the most important thing. And you can trace a line from the Jeffersonian ideal right back at the time of independence, and the ideal that power should be dispersed and that the concentration of jurisdiction was dangerous and that people should have to answer to their electorate. You can trace a line from those principles to the institutions that you just listed, the elected sheriff, the dispersal of power, the recall vote, the citizens initiative, the open primaries. They are very, very unusual. I mean, open primaries don't really exist, not in a meaningful way, in any other country in the world. And what open primaries mean is that instead of having political candidates selected by their party leaderships and then presented as a fait accompli to the electorate, people locally get to choose whom they want. Now, in my own country, and things are even worse in Europe, but in my own country, in the United Kingdom, roughly three-quarters of seats, so over 70% of seats, are effectively owned by one party or another. I mean, this is probably a similar kind of statistic in the US in Congress. The difference is that once you've got elected, you have tenure in Britain. Unless you do something truly monstrous, there isn't really a mechanism to get rid of you, unless your party denies you the right to stand under its colours. And so whenever there is a difference between what your constituents want you to do and what your party leader wants you to do, the rational decision is to go with your whips rather than with your local people, because no one is going to vote for the other party in most seats. And that's where open primaries are so precious, because they take away the concept of a safe seat. They allow somebody else to challenge you for the nomination, and they keep the legislature independent, and they make it more of an effective constraint on the executive. And I think actually, you know what, the Tea Party movement is a real product of that system of dispersed power and open primaries. I've got to say, there's no evidence that my constituents like paying taxes any more than Americans do. Americans will sometimes say, oh, well, you know, the country was founded in a tax revolt and all the rest of it. It's not quite that simple. I mean, there was a tax revolt in Britain before there was a tax revolt in the 13 colonies. It was precisely because the British taxpayers were fed up with paying for the cost of the French and Indian wars that the whole argument began in the first place. Nobody likes paying tax, right? They don't like paying tax in Ecuador. They don't like paying tax in Pakistan. But the difference in the U.S. is that there is something you can do about it. You can pick people that agree with you, and you can get them into the party nomination. In other words, what I'm saying is that the Tea Party is a phenomenon of a system that allows broad currents of public opinion to get in the government. Whereas in Europe, huge chunks of opinion on everything from lower taxes to immigration to leaving the European Union are excluded completely from the parliaments by the system of candidate selection.
You mentioned in your book that Europeans have become accustomed to being, European voters have become accustomed to being ignored.
Yeah, I mean, it's what you hear on doorstep after doorstep. And if you were interviewing a British politician from any party, or a continental politician even more so, and if they were being honest with you, they would all tell you the same thing, which is that the most common response you get on the doorstep is, it doesn't make any difference how I vote, nothing is going to change. Mm. Now, some people say that, I'm sure people even in the US say that in a cynical way, but actually you really are struck when you visit America that they don't really think that, or very few people really think that. People still have lingering faith in the ballot box as a means to deliver change, and the most recent midterm elections are an example of that phenomenon at work. Turnout at elections in Europe is in calamitous decline, not because people have become bored, lazy or cynical, but because abstention is becoming an increasingly rational option when power has shifted from elected representatives to the what you would call the federal czars, what we call the quangos, the unelected bureaucrats and functionaries who take all the decisions that really matter.
One of the things I enjoyed about the book, and I've seen this on some of your YouTube videos as well, is your comparison and contrast of the American Constitution and the European Union Constitution, or your version of it. Share a little of that with us. I think it really drives home the point of one government being about the people, and yet another perhaps being about its own existence.
Well, your constitution, including all the amendments, is 7,200 words long. The European constitution, which is now called the Treaty of Lisbon, is 78,000 words long. Your constitution is mainly about the freedom of the individual. The European one is mainly about the power of the state. Your Declaration of Independence promises life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. The EU's equivalent, which is called the Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms, guarantees our right to strike action, free healthcare, and affordable housing. I think you see the basic categorical difference between the two, that the one is about the individual and the dispersal of power, the other is about the state and the concentration of power. It goes right back to the beginning. You know, your founders, because they had spent their lives fighting against the effects of concentrated power, were determined to prevent a recurrence of the grievances that they had just lived through. And that's why they were so determined to push power down to the lowest practicable level. And that's why, as we were saying earlier, you to this day have these various defenses against state power. In Europe, after the war, the reverse was true. They thought that dispersing power led to populism, to fascism, to war, and so they were determined to concentrate power in the hands of technocrats who didn't need to worry about public opinion, because the EU is run by a 27-member commission of people who are not elected. I mean, this is an incredible thing. The European Commission is the executive and the legislature, basically. It's the equivalent of your White House, and it is the only body that is allowed to propose new legislation. And yet, no one elects its members. Now, we've got used to this, and we cease to see it as the abomination that we ought to. But, you know, if the EU were a country applying to join itself, it would be immediately rejected on grounds of being insufficiently democratic.
The title of the book, The New Road to Serfdom, A Letter of Warning to America, warn us. What signs are you seeing of a Europeanization of America at this point, and why does it concern you?
Well, it started with this administration, a series of policies which were not random initiatives, but which amounted to a comprehensive program of Europeanization. European healthcare, European daycare, European college education, European disarmament, European carbon taxes. And when you've done all of those things, you start getting European unemployment levels, which you've now got for the first time. You know, this is not happening just accidentally or randomly. This is a vision of how the country ought to be. And I am, if you like, living in your future, or rather, I'm living in the future towards which your current rulers seem intent on taking you. I've been here, as you said, for 11 years in the European Parliament. I've seen how it's going to work out, and believe me, my friends, you're not going to like it. The things that have served to make your country prosperous and independent and free, devolution of power, emphasis on the big citizen and the small state, the national particularisms that were recognised in the Constitution, if those things are tossed away, you won't be able to get them back.
We still have a little time left, so I'd like to get your take on a couple of more issues. Do you find it amusing that when you look at all the things that added up to the economic meltdown in the United States, the role of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the role of Acorn, the subprime mortgages, the Community Reinvestment Act, repeal of many aspects of Glass-Steagall, do you find it interesting that with all the different components of the economic meltdown, that many people take the simplistic view of Bush was president, it's George W. Bush's fault?
Well, many commentators took that view. I think your people, your electorate was much more against the bailouts and the nationalizations and the other expansions of state power than legislators in either party at that time. You didn't, in your list of government failings, mention what is for me the biggest one of all, the underlying one, which is that the Fed and the Bank of England and the European Central Bank and probably also the Bank of Japan were all guilty of artificially keeping interest rates too low for too long. And that was a political decision, not a market decision. They blew air into the bubble that was going to have to come out one way or another. So to turn around and blame this on a failure of the capitalist system, I think is grossly wrong. But, you know, if I've learned anything in politics, it's to trust people before I trust their leaders. And one of the things that was very striking in the aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of the financial crash at the end of 2008, was that in your country as in mine, a consensus was formed almost immediately around a bailout and a rescue package and a stimulus and all the rest of it. As soon as the opinion polls came in Britain and in the US, it turned out that three quarters of people, quite correctly, saw no argument for taxpayers being expected to rescue some very wealthy individuals from the consequences of their own errors. So then, as usual, the people were wiser than their rulers.
From the end of World War II to the early 1970s, Europe actually outperformed the United States in terms of economic growth. Is that perhaps suggestive of the fact that socialism isn't as bad as many on the right in America think it is?
Well, you know, these days I think we can see why that happened. Europe in 1945 was at an artificial low point. What I mean by that is that the Second World War had degraded infrastructure. I mean, it had destroyed factories and bridges and so on. But it hadn't destroyed what is the greatest resource of any nation, which is its people. I mean, there was still a disciplined and industrialized and educated workforce there. So in a way, starting from 1945, there was bound to be growth for the next kind of 30 years. That's especially true when you factor in that there was migration for the first time. There was migration within countries, people moving from the countryside to towns. There was migration within Europe, people moving in millions from the Mediterranean to the coal fields and the steelworks in the north of Europe. And, of course, there was migration from outside, from the British and French and Dutch colonies, from Turkey, from North Africa, and so on. With all of those things going on, it would have been difficult for Europe not to grow. But they then, on top of all those advantages, had this massive external stimulus of U.S. aid, $13 billion dispersed between 1948 and 1952, on top of the $12 billion already given under Marshall Aid, and, of course, the security guarantee, which meant that European countries didn't need to spend as much money on defense, and it was freed up for civil programs or for lower taxes. Put all of those things together, and how could Europe not have been an economic miracle in the immediate post-war years? Unfortunately, of course, the leaders of Europe didn't see it like that. Human nature being what it is, you maybe wouldn't expect them to. They didn't say, oh, well, you know, we're doing much better because the Americans were helping us and because we were bouncing back from an artificial low point. What they said instead was, we're doing better because I'm such a genius. You know, my policies have been fantastic. I've hit on this amazing third way between capitalism and socialism, you know, this mixed market economy and corporatism and negotiation between government and big business and all of these things and the labor unions. And, you know, they genuinely believed and still believe that. But what we've seen since the mid-1970s is the consequences of that system. The European Union has fallen further and further and further behind the rest of the world. It's become bloated. High unemployment has become structural. Productivity has fallen. The worst statistic that I can quote, the most scary statistic that I can quote, is on share of world GDP. I mean, in the mid-70s, Western Europe was 36% of the world's economic activity. Today, it's 26%, and in the year 2020, it'll be 15%. This, by the way, over a period when the U.S. share of world GDP has remained roughly steady, so it isn't just, you know, power shifting to Asia. Europe has made itself poor by adopting statist and corporatist policies. And you guys do not have the excuse of not having the example in front of your noses. I mean, at least the European leaders could say to themselves, well, this has never been tried before. You guys can see that it has been tried before. It's been tried before where I'm sitting now. And that makes it, to me, utterly bizarre that you're repeating the same mistakes.
Well, you've sounded the alarm bells. You've given us the warning, but there's an old saying, if you bring up problems and you don't have solutions, you're just griping. So tell us, Mr. Hannon, what is the path out? What immediate steps must America take to change course and prevent the same history from unfolding here?
The most immediate step is to stop printing money. I mean, you know, let's have the insulin injection right away and keep the patient alive before we start worrying about the major surgery. Stop printing money, start cutting spending, and start raising interest rates. But as for the wider solution, look, you know, I don't need to come up with one. It's written in your constitution. There were sublime ideas put together by men of extraordinary genius, and they worked. They did exactly what they were meant to do. They made the country rich. They made it powerful, to the benefit of the rest of the world, as well as to the U.S. itself, because it was the dream of your constitution, the promise of your settlement, that drove your fathers to carry liberty to other continents as well, which for which the world owes you one. It seems to me that you don't need to reinvent the wheel. You just should have you should elect leaders who have the modesty to recognize that they are passing through institutions that are bigger than they are, and that one generation which purports to change the whole constitutional settlement, to shift power from the 50 states to Washington, to shift power from the legislature to the executive, to shift power from the elected representative to the unelected official, and to shift power from the citizen to the state, is behaving in a way that makes America less American, by which I mean less successful and less prosperous and less free.
I want to let all our listeners know that if they'd like to get a copy of your book, they need to do nothing more than scroll down to the bottom of our website page where we have The New Road to Serfdom, a letter of warning from Daniel Hammond, linked. You can click on that link. You'll be transported immediately to Amazon.com where you will be able to order the book with a couple of clicks of a button. Mr. Hannon, I want to thank you very much for being here today. The book is a very enjoyable read. It's a very well-timed warning to America, and I always find it interesting that people outside the U.S. often know us better than we know ourselves.
Mark, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure, and let me say thank you to anyone listening who's been part of the Tea Party movement. You guys are the true sons of liberty, and you are the true stewards and custodians of a great tradition, and I hope that your children and grandchildren will recognize what it is you've done for them.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.